Okay, Jayla, let's dive into hemodynamic monitoring. It's an essential part of critical care nursing, and it gives us insights into the pressure, flow, and oxygenation within the cardiovascular system.
So, like, it's basically monitoring how well the heart and blood vessels are working together?
Exactly. We look at things like cardiac output. That's the volume of blood the heart pumps in a minute, and systemic vascular resistance, which measures the resistance the heart has to pump against. Together, these help us assess how well the heart is functioning and whether the tissues are receiving enough oxygen.
That makes sense. And I guess there are, like, invasive and non-invasive ways to do this?
Right. Non-invasive methods include physical assessments and monitoring vital signs, things like blood pressure, heart rate, or even pulse oximetry. But for more precise data, we use invasive techniques like arterial lines or pulmonary artery catheters. These can measure parameters like central venous pressure or pulmonary artery wedge pressure.
Those names sound scary. I mean, when you say invasive, there are risks involved, right?
There are, yes. Infections, thrombus formation, and hemorrhage are the big ones we watch for. That's why proper technique is so critical. For example, when using an arterial line, we ensure it's properly zeroed and referenced, always aligned with the phlebostatic axis, to minimize complications and get accurate readings.
Wait, hold on. The phlebostatic axis?
Good question. It's basically a reference point on the chest, aligned with the level of the atria in the mid-axillary line. It helps ensure the pressure readings aren't skewed by the patient's position.
Oh, okay. And what about advanced techniques? I think I heard you mention arterial pressure-based cardiac output monitoring.
That's right. This technique continuously monitors cardiac output through arterial waveform analysis, which can help us track real-time changes in a patient's condition. It's particularly helpful in dynamic situations like sepsis or post-surgery.
So it's kind of like having a constant update on how the patient's heart is doing.
Exactly. But, you know, even with advanced tools, the basics, keeping a close eye on trends, repositioning the patient carefully, monitoring for signs of infection are what really make a difference. It's not just about the technology. It's about how we use it to improve outcomes for the patient.
Got it. So it's like blending technology with that hands-on care we do.
Absolutely. And understanding these systems, Jayla, is what helps you trust your instincts in clinical situations. We're not just treating numbers on a screen, we're treating people. Now that we've covered the essentials of hemodynamic monitoring, let's talk about one of the critical conditions it helps us manage, shock. Shock is a complex topic, but at its core, it's a state where the body's tissues aren't getting enough oxygen to meet their needs, leading to potentially serious complications.
So it's like the organs aren't getting what they need to do their job?
Exactly. And there are different types of shock depending on what's causing the imbalance. For example, cardiogenic shock happens when the heart can't pump effectively, while distributive shock, think anaphylaxis or septic shock, causes massive vasodilation. Both lead to poor tissue perfusion just through different mechanisms.
Wait, so in distributive shock, it's not that there's less blood, but it's just like not where it needs to be?
Exactly. The volume is there, but the vessels are so dilated that blood isn't reaching the organs effectively. That's why we use vasopressors in those cases to help tighten up the blood vessels.
Okay. And cardiogenic shock, how does that play out in the body?
Great question. With cardiogenic shock, the heart fails as a pump. It could be due to a massive myocardial infarction or something like severe heart failure. The end result is poor cardiac output, which means less oxygen is delivered to the tissues.
That sounds scary. Is there, a way to catch it early?
There is, but it requires vigilance. We monitor for things like hypotension, altered mental status, or poor urine output. These are signs the tissues aren't being perfused well. That's why early interventions, like optimizing fluid levels and using inotropes to improve heart contractility, are so crucial.
And what about the stages of shock? I think I remember there's an initial phase where it's kind of silent.
Exactly. The initial stage is mostly cellular changes. You won't always see outward symptoms, but as it progresses, you get into the compensatory stage, where the body activates the sympathetic nervous system to try and maintain perfusion. If untreated, though, it moves into the progressive stage, where organs start to dysfunction. And the refractory stage? Well, that's often irreversible organ damage.
That's heavy. Have you, had a patient progress to that stage?
Unfortunately, yes. I had a patient with septic shock that progressed rapidly. We did everything, from giving aggressive fluids to starting multiple vasopressors, but they were already in the refractory phase by the time they came to us. It was a hard lesson in recognizing sepsis early and acting quickly.
That must have been tough. So, timing is really everything then?
It truly is. Early identification and intervention can mean the difference between recovery and multi-organ failure. But the biggest takeaway for me was that even when you know the textbook answers, every patient's journey is unique. Sometimes it's not just about what you do. It's about doing it at the exact right moment.
I think that's what scares me, honestly. Like, will I catch it fast enough?
And that's why we practice, Jayla. The more you understand the pathophysiology and patterns of shock, the more confident you'll feel in clinical settings. It's not about being perfect from the start. It's about getting a little sharper every time you encounter it. You're absolutely right, Jayla. Timing really is everything, especially when it comes to conditions like SIRS and MODS. Let's explore them. As understanding these can help you recognize high-risk patients and act early. SIRS, or systemic inflammatory response syndrome, is the body's response to triggers like infection, trauma, or even surgery. If it's not managed effectively, it can progress to MODS, multiple organ dysfunction syndrome, where multiple systems start to fail.
So it's like the body's response spirals out of control?
That's a good way to put it. Imagine the immune system going into overdrive. At first, it's trying to protect the body, but then, well, it starts causing harm. In MODS, the damage becomes systemic, affecting organs like the kidneys, lungs, or even the brain.
And once that happens, is it like too late to reverse it?
Not always, but it becomes more complicated. The key is preventing CIRS from progressing. Infection control, like early antibiotics and sterile technique, is vital. We also focus on supporting failing organs, whether through mechanical ventilation, dialysis, or even blood transfusions.
So basically, every part of the care team has a role, right?
Exactly. It's truly interprofessional care at its finest. And as nurses, we're in a unique position to monitor for early warning signs, things like changes in heart rate, urine output, or oxygen levels. Those subtle shifts might seem small, but they can tell us a lot about how the patient's organs are coping.
Right. I actually remember during a sim lab exercise on DIC, our instructor pointed out how important it was to notice those little changes. But I kind of froze. I kept second guessing myself. And by the time I spoke up about the patient's abnormal labs, they said it was too late. Honestly, it shook me.
DIC, or disseminated intravascular coagulation, is tough to manage, even for experienced nurses. It's this paradoxical condition where the body is both clotting and bleeding at the same time. Recognizing it early through symptoms like unexpected bruising, oozing from IV sachet, and psyches they and eyes gay so or can she our abnormal lab results is critical. But Jayla, what I want you to take away from that simulation is that freezing up doesn't define you. It's a step in learning.
I guess. But how do you like stay confident when there's so much at stake?
Confidence comes from preparation and experience. The more you familiarize yourself with the patterns of conditions like SIRS, MODS, and DIC, the easier it'll be to trust what you know. And remember, it's not about being perfect. It's about doing your best to interpret the signs you see, ask for help when needed, and keep the patient's best interest at heart.
That makes sense. I guess it's less about knowing all the answers and more about acting on what I do know, huh?
Exactly. You don't need to have all the answers, Jayla. You just need to start somewhere. Assess, question, intervene. Critical care is a team sport, after all. And when in doubt, use your resources. It's why we have multidisciplinary rounds and protocols in place.
You're right. I'll try to remember that next time. Just trust myself and focus on what the patient needs in that moment.
That's the mindset of a great nurse in the making. You're growing, Jayla, and the more you challenge yourself, the closer you'll get to becoming the kind of nurse you strive to be. And that's all for today. It's been great talking through these topics with you. Thanks for your honesty and insights.
Thank you. I feel like I've got a lot to think about, and I'm excited to keep learning from these discussions. Oh, and practicing more.
That's all anyone can ask for. On that note, we'll see you all next time. Take care, everyone.